needed to be done in order to find Tasha Kanan. Dar was piloting the airship now, while Brecken used the Elfstones to help set their direction. But the Elfstones, after projecting a few final faint images of Tasha, went dark. Brecken shook his head as he lowered the stones and turned to his companion.
"I remember my father saying something once about movement disrupting the search power of the stones. If either the searcher or the object of the search is moving too quickly, in an airship, for example, the stones have difficulty tracking. Maybe that's so with Tasha. We need to go to where we saw her with those men, in any case, just to see what happened. We can try to find out more when we get there."
But it took them the rest of that day and the following two before they located the place they were looking for on the morning of the third day, and when they got there, Tasha was nowhere to be found. They walked the entirety of the area where the airship had landed, searching. After several minutes, Dar knelt in what seemed to be a patch of scorched earth. His hands moved across the damaged ground.
"Look at this." Brecken walked over. "Magic has been used here," Dar announced. "I can smell its residue."
He rose.
"Tasha defended herself against someone or something, then got back in her airship and set out again."
He thought a moment.
"I'm guessing, but maybe she's gone back to Emberon." "But Driscoll isn't there," Brecken pointed out. "You said so yourself. He can't be there. He's trapped in Paranor."
"She doesn't know that. She doesn't know anything about Paranor. Whatever happened with the search for her brother, it doesn't involve backing Fel anymore, or she wouldn't be flying the other way.
Maybe she found him, and maybe she didn't. Maybe she decided to go back to Driscoll to see if he's returned, maybe to ask his help if she didn't find Tavo."
Brecken looked doubtful.
"Awful lot of maybes. Let's try using the Elfstones again. Maybe this time we'll have better luck."
He retrieved the pouch from his pocket and dumped the stones into the palm of his hand. Tightening his grip on them, he lifted his arm and pointed north, eyes closing. Moments passed, but there was no response. Then, abruptly, an image of Tasha sleeping in a bed surfaced once and was gone. Dar and Brecken exchanged glances.
"Did you recognize anything?"
the latter asked.
Dar nodded slowly. "The room was too dark to be sure, but it might have been the cottage Driscoll moved to when his own was burned down."
"Burned down?"
"Long story. His house was attacked and burned not too long ago. He told me the story while we were flying back to Paranor. I didn't see much of the inside, but that might have been a bedroom."
Brecken clapped him on the shoulder.
"So let's you and I go there and find out."
He nodded, but the expression on his face indicated he remained dissatisfied. His friend put the Elfstones away and walked back to the airship. Moments later, they reboarded their airship and set out once more. Tasha was deep in slumber when the dream came. She felt its approach, a kind of tingling in the air, a drop in the temperature. A presence nudged up against her, and she was aware of someone standing next to her bed. She lacked any interest in knowing who it was and did not allow the dream to wake her. It was unobtrusive and only vaguely interesting, and the simple fact of it was not enough to trouble her. Then a voice spoke.
"Wake up, Tasha."
She ignored the command. And it was a command because there was considerable force behind it. But dreams are insubstantial, and she felt no urgency to respond.
"Tasha, you must wake."
Forceful now, more insistent and sharp-edged with concern. She felt a shift in the nature of its intent, and she wondered in a vague sort of way if this was a dream after all.
"Tasha, now! Look at me!"
Definitely not a dream. She rose from the depths of her slumber, finding her way to consciousness, even as the sleeping potion sought to hold her down. Her eyes opened, and she was looking at Driscoll Ark. Which, of course, was impossible. According to Clesia, he was imprisoned in banished Paranor. He didn't even look like himself, but rather appeared as a sort of insubstantial, ghostly version of the man he had been, his features shifting as if formed of mist, threatening to evaporate at any second. There was no weight to him. There was nothing to suggest he was anything but a wraith.
"Driscoll?"
she said, disbelieving. Her voice was sluggish, weary. She was awake, but struggling to stay there. She took note of her darkened room. Night had clearly fallen in Emberon. The sole light was provided by Driska's ghost, its body radiating a strange whiteness that suggested glimmerings of movement seen most often from the corners of one's eyes. With great effort, she raised herself on one elbow.
"Driska? What happened to you?"
The wraith knelt by her bedside but made no move to touch her. It seemed likely that he couldn't, that his form would not permit it. There was a shimmer to his body, and its smallest movements cast shadows across the walls and floor of the darkened bedroom.
"I am trapped inside Paranor."
Even his voice sounded otherworldly, a faint echo skidding off each word before trailing away.
"I cannot stay long. The spell won't let me. But I have information you need to know."
She stared at him.
"How can you be here if you were trapped inside Paranor?" "Magic. This happened to a druid once before, hundreds of years ago. His name was Cogline. He was a failed druid, and his story is too long to tell. What matters is that magic placed him inside Paranor after the druid Alanon had consigned it to Limbo. While he was there, he could not escape on his own. But he discovered he could send an image of himself anywhere he wanted to, just as I am doing."
She nodded slowly.
"So you're not really here. But this isn't your shade, either. You aren't dead." "I'm not dead. Plesir Pors wishes I were. It was she who did this to me. She tricked me while we were inside the keep summoning its guardian, and left me for dead while she fled. Once clear of Paranor's walls, she used her magic to send the keep out of the Four Lands, in order to keep it safe for her personal use later. She betrayed Paranor to the invaders, and the druids are no more. She plans to rebuild the druid order, with herself as Ard Rhys. Listen to me now. Clesia is playing a game, and you are her pawn. She is not your friend."
"I don't understand.
It was Clesia who helped me recover when I returned from searching for—" "She is not your friend. She is pretending. While you have been sleeping, she has been busy trying to use you against me. You will remember she has a scry orb, just as I do. Well, she used it to contact me and offer me my freedom if I would bring her a powerful magic called a Black Elf Stone. She showed me an image of you sleeping and hinted that you would be safe, only so long as she got what she wanted. She keeps you with her to use as a bargaining tool. As long as she thinks I will bring her the magic she wants, she won't hurt you. But she won't wait long. I need you to get out of there as soon as you can, any way that you can."
Tasha was fully awake now, sitting up and facing Driska.
"What about you?" "Do not worry for me. I will find a way out on my own. Go to Dali if you can find him. If not, go to the elves and ask for sanctuary. Do it right away. But be very careful. If she finds out what you are trying to do, she will bind you so securely you will never get free. You will likely only have one chance, so wait until you find it. Then run, and don't look back. She will come after you, but you must hide yourself."
"Not very comforting."
Tasha was struggling to accept that she had been wrong about Clesia, even given Driska's earlier warnings and her own suspicions when the old woman had asked about the books of magic. She was angry for allowing herself to be deceived.
"I don't know where Dali is. Can you help me find him? Can you go to him as you've come to me and ask him to help?
Coming to you wasn't as easy as it might seem. I don't know how many more times I can do so. I wouldn't have known I could do it at all if not for the druid histories. In their recordings it told of how Cogline was trapped within Paranor, but he found he could leave by projecting his spirit self, his almost shade, out into the world. He only needed direction and knowledge of his destination. He used it to search out Walker Bo, the druid of his time. But there was a price for doing so. Each time he projected himself as a spirit, it took something from his corporeal form. He became further weakened and diminished. If he were to continue, he would disappear altogether. That is the risk I run as well."
"Then you must go now. Don't stay any longer. I can manage well enough now that I know the truth about Clesia."
He rose and stood looking down at her, his face a mask of worry.
"Be wary, Tasha. Clesia Pors is extremely dangerous, and she would snuff out your life without a second's hesitation if she thought it necessary. You must not reveal I was here. You must not reveal what you have learned from me. You must not let her discover what you intend. This is asking a lot, but your life depends on how well you are able to manage the charade I am asking of you." She nodded. "I understand. Just try to find a way out quickly. I need you. Tavo has killed all my family, and it may be that he intends to kill me as well. He was coming to Emberon, so I came back here to find him. But now I don't know what to do. Do only what I told you for now. That is enough. I will find a way to reach you. Look for me."
And he was gone, vanished from her sleeping chamber as if he had never been there, the room gone dark again, the air gone still and empty. Tasha stayed propped up on one elbow for a moment, struggling with what she had been told, still not entirely sure it was real. If she hadn't been a wielder of magic herself, and aware of the strangeness that magic could perform, she would have doubted her senses. But she knew Driska had been there, even if in diminished form, and had spoken to her. She knew everything he had said was true, and now she must do what she could to save herself. She lay back, slowly, eyes peering upward into the darkness. So much had happened in so short a time. She had made the journey to find Driska and ask him to train her, and the druid had taken her in. The Scar had invaded the Four Lands and taken Paranor, killing all the druids. Driska's home had been burned. Someone was trying to kill him, and now it appeared it was as he suspected, a fellow member of the fallen druid order. Yet he had gone to Paranor anyway, to try to save those he had once led. And she had gone in search of Tavo and found only the horrific death of her parents, the destruction of her home, and the enmity of her friends and neighbours. What had she accomplished in all this? Not much, she decided. Mostly, she had been struggling to find her way in the world, and her way remained a mystery. She remembered the old woman Parlin drew and her prophecies. The rule of three would be her fate, she had told her. Three times she would love, but only one would endure. Three times she would die, but each death would see her rise anew. And three times she would have a chance to make a difference in the lives of others, and three times would do so. But once only would her actions change the world. So the old woman had told her, an old woman no one else saw, even though they had shared glasses of ale openly in a public house. Tasha's thoughts shifted away from the prophecies and returned to her present predicament. There was no time for worrying about something so abstract and distant. She had to deal with the problem at hand. She had to get herself beyond Clizia Porse's reach, but she had to plan carefully how to do so. She had to fool the old woman into believing nothing had changed, while she prepared to slip away. She had to be smart. She had to be wary. She could not afford to be afraid. But it was too late for that. She was terrified. Her eyes were suddenly heavy. The medication, she thought at once, a drug, perhaps intended to keep her in line. But she needed to rest in any event, her recovery not yet complete. She would think about things once more when she woke. Nevertheless, it took her a long time to fall back asleep.
15. Araxin Dresch, first commander of the Federation Army, assembled two companies of frontline soldiers in response to the orders from Keter Vows, provisioned a transport, readied three warships and set out for the Myrmidon on the same day, as ordered. Even before departing, he sent a flit ahead to provide him with a more up-to-date report on the movements of the Scar. Whatever lay ahead for his men, he intended to be ready for it. He was a lifer, a career soldier with more than 30 years of service. He had begun as a lowly lieutenant, but rose swiftly through the ranks to his present position, which he had assumed 5 years ago when his predecessor retired. He had fought in the Dwarf Wars at the edge of the southern Anar, and subdued an uprising of miners that threatened the Southland's monopoly on the metals needed for making weapons and airships. He had hunted gnome raiders in the far Northland when they began interfering in the shipping of goods to and from the major Southland cities, smashing a ring of pirates that had virtually shut down the air lanes north and east. His record as a commander was impressive and distinguished, and he did not intend to let it be sullied by some barbaric foreign invader. Another few years,
and it would be time for him to take retirement, and he wanted his career to end well. As a result, he was determined not to be overconfident or reckless in his present undertaking. He understood better than most the risks you ran as a Federation Army commander. He understood the value of being able to ascertain when to hold back and when to strike hard. He relied on tactics and experience to see him through the tougher assignments. He chose his subordinates wisely, and he listened to what they had to say, even when they disagreed with him. So it was now, as his command vessel led his fleet north out of the Southland and into the Borderlands, flying just west of the Dalm Forest in a direct approach to Callahorn and the Myrmidon. He stood with his sub-commanders, Croy and Presselin. Both had been with him for more than 10 years, and each of them pretty much knew what to expect from the other. Ahead, the day was sunny and clear, and the sweep of the Don's green canopy was bright with promise. They had flown most of the day yesterday and through the night, and now they were only a few hours from their destination. The three were discussing what lay ahead, and what sort of difficulties or threats might be facing them.
"These Skark, and how did you put it?"
Idaeus Presselin was saying. He was a short, powerfully built man, blunt-spoken and aggressive. In battle he had no equal, a warrior through and through.
"Did you say they could appear and disappear at will?"
Dresch nodded.
"So it is reported. But we have no first-hand experience with this because we haven't faced them ourselves."
"But they annihilated the armies sent against them by several troll tribes," Croy observed. "They must possess some considerable advantage to achieve victories of that sort."
Tall, slender and diffident, he was the more cautious and far-thinking of the two sub-commanders. To Dresch's way of thinking, he was the perfect complement to the more fiery Presselin.
"Because they succeeded in defeating a couple of bands of disorganized, undisciplined savages?"
Presselin dismissed Croy's words with a wave of his hand.
"A Federation command would have done the same."
"They managed to get inside Paranor and destroy the druids," Croy added. "I don't recall that Federation forces have been able to do that."
"They are dangerous, and we need to think of them that way,"
Dresch interrupted before they could start arguing again. He valued their differences of opinion because they approached problems from polar opposite mindsets, but it was also sometimes annoying.
"We don't want to assume anything else until we've taken their measure."
Presselin made another dismissive sound.
"Doesn't matter to me if they can disappear or not. Give me a Federation phalanx with airship support and I'll blanket the whole killing field with fire and iron, then see how many are left standing." "Well, we have to determine if they are a threat to the Federation first."
Dresch was looking out toward the first silvery glimmerings of the Myrmidon.
"Our orders are very clear. We are to defend the south shore of the river and not cross over. If the Skar attempt to cross from their side, we can retaliate. But we need to be certain they have aggressive intentions." "Because maybe they intend to enjoy a nice holiday after coming all the way from another continent. Any fool could ascertain their intentions, Commander. All we are doing is marking time until they make their move against us. And they will. There's no other reason for them to come this far south, no reason for them to have fought those troll tribes, and I don't care what their precious princess says about their plans."
Dresch gave him a disapproving look. The way his sub-commander was dismissing Arjun Diamphir worried him. Presselin clearly assumed a young woman could never be a match for him in battle, but Dresch was not so sure. He was a firm believer in never underestimating an opponent. If her skills in future battles were anything close to what they had proved to be thus far, since coming into the Four Lands, she could be very dangerous indeed. But he let his sub-commander's comments pass for the moment. There would be time enough later, in private, to address his misguided sense of superiority.
"How will we set our defensive lines?" Murian Croy asked.
"Line the south banks with one company directly across from wherever the Skar have set their camp. Divide the other company in two and place half on each wing, far enough back so that they cannot be seen from the other side of the river, a precaution against any attempt to outflank us. We will hold the airships safely behind the lines, ready to come to our aid should the need arise."
"But shouldn't we be worried about who might come to their aid?"
Croy asked softly.
Dresch turned to him.
"What do you mean?"
"How did they get all the way here from their homeland? Sailing ships, perhaps?
But what if they have airships, too? What if they have warships, equal or superior to ours? How do we defend against that?
The other two men stared at him.
There have been no reports of airships, Commander Croy,
Presselin snapped. Dresch held up his hand to silence him and faced Croy.
Explain your thinking, Commander.
The fact that no one has seen any SCAR airships doesn't mean they don't exist. This advance force, commanded by a warrior princess whom you admit you think is intelligent, has penetrated deep into the Four Lands. By marching all the way to the banks of the Myrmidon, she has effectively cut herself off from any retreat or escape by foot. How much sense does it make for her to do that, unless she has a method of escape beyond retreating on foot?
Go on.
Dresch was experiencing a sudden misgiving.
It makes sense for the SCAR to have airships waiting to carry them out, should the tide go against them. Also, they must know that we have such vessels. So even if they brought none with them, they will have commandeered some of ours by now.
Presselin nodded slowly, grudgingly.
I agree. It would be insane to advance against the Federation if they didn't.
He paused.
Unless they have no intention of advancing farther, and are only doing what they told the Prime Minister they would.
Even if that was so, Dresch replied, they could not be certain a third party wouldn't attack them at some point. No, I feel certain that Murien has it right. The SCAR must have airships waiting in reserve.
Which means, Croy interjected, we need to be prepared to neutralize them if they attack us, because besides having transports, they are likely to have warships as well.
Which also means, Dresch added pointedly, that we must find and monitor them in case the need to neutralize them arises.
He gave his sub-commander a nod of approval.
Well reasoned, Murien. I'm giving you the task of finding those ships and preventing them from acting against us. They are to be found and watched. Any antagonistic movement on their part is to be halted by an incisive and dominant retaliatory strike. Those are your orders, sub-commander.
The other man nodded.
I will make certain they are carried out. Give me command of two squads equipped with diapson-powered explosives, and you will have no reason to worry.
They talked further, but the greater part of their plan was now in place. Dresch was grateful to Croy for thinking of the possibility of SCAR airships, but chagrined at his own failure to think of it first. He was reminded that Murien Croy was the logical choice to succeed him when he retired. Idias Presselin was too unimaginative and hot-headed to ever be first commander of the Federation Army. Croy had always been better suited for the position. At the same time, he didn't want to retire until he was ready. But what if he was incapable of realizing when it was his time? What if his age was already catching up with him, and he couldn't see it? If Ketavaz took notice of his failure to consider certain obvious possibilities, he might be forced to step down more quickly than he had planned. And he didn't like thinking that the choice might be made for him. After his sub-commanders had departed, he retired to his quarters to stand at his desk, where maps of the Myrmidon and its north and south banks were spread before him, and studied them intently. Given that the SCAR had annihilated two troll tribes and the entire druid order, anticipating what they might do once their army faced his was important. Their small numbers, somewhere around 1,000, the reports said, did not suggest they would risk a full-blown assault against even a single Federation company, let alone two. They would be woefully outnumbered in unfamiliar territory. Moreover, the reports received so far indicated they found antiquated weapons, blades, spears, bows and arrows and the like, adequate for modern battles, which made no sense. Flash rips and rail slings combined with cannons would cut them to pieces. There was no reason to believe they would chance so much by launching an attack on a superior and better equipped force. On the other hand, they had somehow gotten through Paranor's considerable defences, past walls and gates and wards of magic, to destroy virtually all the druids within the keep. They had essentially wiped the druids and their order off the face of the Four Lands. Even druid magic had not been enough to stop them. It was troubling beyond words. Dresch stepped away from the maps. He was going to have to be very careful in the days ahead. The Federation Command had arrived to establish camp across the Myrmidon from the SCAR at midday of the previous day, a day after Argin herself had returned from Arbalon. Now, as twilight was approaching and the Federation soldiers were once again preparing to settle in for the night, the Scar Princess stood with Coldray on a rise to the north, less than a mile across from the other encampment, studying its impressive sprawl. The smells of cooking drifted in on the back of a warm south wind, and the shadowy figures of the soldiers were visible as they passed between tents and patches of firelight, busy at their tasks, seemingly heedless of the Scar advance force. Arjun was satisfied to leave it that way. She wanted them to think little or nothing of what the Scar might be up to, less still of any potential danger. They should lose interest as routine and familiarity blunted the edges of their caution. She wanted them overconfident. They would begin to decide that nothing was going to happen, that this was a preventive action and the Scar were doing exactly what Arjun had told Ketavaz they intended to do. The Scar had arrived and taken a defensive position, and any difficulties with the Federation would be settled by negotiation, by words, rather than weapons. After all, theirs was the strongest army in all the four lands, and what sense did it make to offer a challenge with so few aggressors? The Scar numbered less than 1,000, and the contingent of Federation soldiers dispatched to keep an eye on them numbered more than twice that. Plus, the Federation had warships and advanced diapson crystal-powered weapons. Alone in the middle of enemy territory and facing a seasoned command, why would the Scar even think of tempting fate by provoking an armed response? Only a fool poked a sleeping bear with a sharp stick. An old bromide, but Arjun had never been one for bromides. Yes, she wanted them confident and complacent, for a few short hours. And then she wanted them angry and confused, because frightened, confused men made mistakes. "Are you ready, Coldray?" she asked him. He had arrived back in camp the same day she had, albeit a bit later. "Of course," he answered impatiently, a hint of reproof in his voice. "Patience in all things. It was you who taught me that. Now then, I want it done while I still think nothing is going to happen." He nodded. "Are you sure about this, Arjun? Once we do this, there is no going back. They'll respond with everything they've got, and we don't have the full army behind us yet." Arjun considered for a moment. It was a risk, striking at them like this. A big risk. But if they succeeded, which she was certain in her Arjun fashion they would, it would leave the Federation hierarchy deeply unsure about what it could expect its army to achieve in an all-out battle against the Scar, and open up new possibilities for negotiations. "If you do what you are supposed to, we won't need my father's intervention. By the time my father arrives, I will be in complete control of the situation. He would never consider dismissing me then, even with Baranor lost. Sten Orr will look like a fool."
"Sten Orr has his ear, Arjun," he said quietly. "Your father's man, his spy in your camp. I wouldn't be so sure of this."
She gave him a look.
"My father's man? I don't think so. The Pretenders, most definitely. Besides, things might not be entirely as Sten Orr believes them."
She skipped right past any attempt at an explanation.
"I am entrusting you with our future, Coldray. Am I right to do so?"
His look was dark and angry.
"How can you even ask me that?"
She shrugged.
"Because I worry. Too often you have to play the chameleon, Penetrator. And even I am not always sure of your true feelings. That girl, the one at Paranor, Alice, she caught your eye, didn't she? You thought I didn't know, but I did. I know everything about you, Coldray. I had once thought you loved me. Now I wonder."
She watched him squirm, just as she had intended.
"I do love you," he insisted.
"You know I always have. But it is hard to feel as I do, and know it will never come to anything. So yes, I was tempted, but it was only momentary. I killed her in the end, didn't I? I know where I belong. I know who my people are."
Cleverly said, Arjun thought. But how truthful was he being? Did even he know? Time to offer him an inducement.
"There are other ways you can be with me,"
she said quietly, offering him a glimmer of hope.
He stared, surprised.
"You have never said so before?"
"Some things take longer than others. I have cared for you all along, Cole. You must have sensed that in the way I treated you. I did not take you to my bed because I did not want our relationship to change, and perhaps I was cruel in not doing so, especially when inviting so many others. But you are my favorite. You always have been." He shook his head.
"I wish I could believe that."
"Oh, so now I need to prove myself," she snapped. When he started to protest, she gave him a hard shove. "Let him squirm a little more." "No, don't deny it. You want to see proof of how I feel about you, but you'll just have to wait. I do care for you, and I don't want to feel any doubt about that reliance. And I need to be sure you can stay loyal to me no matter what. I need to know, too, that in this one instance particularly, in this place and time, you will stay strong and do what you have said you will." He studied her a moment.
"This is about your father, isn't it?
When he arrives, you want to know if I will still stand with you or side with him. Am I correct?" She kept her expression neutral with considerable effort. "No. This is about you and me, Cole. This is about how the rest of this campaign is going to turn out. I have already suffered betrayal from Sten Orr, who goes behind my back to involve my father and bring me to heel. I am merely a woman, of course, young and weak and callow. Don't I need minding? Many still think so, from either misguided concern or jealousy at my success. I know this is true, and so do you. So, if I cannot depend on you to treat me differently, as an equal at the very least, I need to know. This is my life we are talking about, and your eyes have wandered once already on this expedition. I want to know it won't happen again. I want to know you will stand by me every time I am threatened, even if it means your own life might be at risk. I am alone, Cole. My soldiers are loyal, but not at the expense of defying my father. You are the only close friend I have, and the only one I trust. So tell me, am I mistaken to think so?" Coldray stared at her for a long moment, and then he dropped to one knee, keeping his gaze on her face. "You are not mistaken, not now or before. I will never betray or abandon you, Arjun, not even if it means defying your father, not even if it costs me my life." A surge of satisfaction rippled through her, and she reached down to take him by his shoulders and raise him back to his feet.
"I am pleased to hear you say so," she whispered,
not bothering to hide the strong emotions she was feeling.
"I accept your word, and will not question it again."
Alone, in the darkness, they embraced and held each other. Coldray had responded to her prodding exactly the way she wanted him to. He was still hers in all the ways she needed him to be. Arjun found the moment incredibly satisfying. 2 hours later, Coldray flew out of their encampment with 5 other Scar soldiers, following the north bank of the Myrmidon River west for several miles, before crossing over to the south and turning back toward the campfires of the Federation Army. Arjun went with them, of course. Coldray objected vehemently, reminding her of how dangerous this excursion was and what the cost would be if she were killed or captured. She smiled at his concern and told him not to worry. All would be well. Because Arjun the Amphir never asked her soldiers to do anything she wouldn't do herself. And after the disaster at Paranor, she felt she had something to prove. Midnight along the Myrmidon, and the sky was clear and filled with stars. A moon descending to the southeast gave that quadrant of the heavens an even brighter glow. The air was fresh and sweet with the smells of the forest and a river far enough removed from the city of Varfleet that none of its industrial stench was in evidence. A rustling in the grasses signalled the approach of some small nocturnal animal, its passage audible only because of the deep night quiet. Even the hunting owls and the smaller night birds made no sounds as they swooped from tree to tree, their winged flights nothing more than the passage of shadows. The Federation guards on the western flank took disinterested note of everything, spread out in a precisely staggered pair of sentry lines stretched across the very perimeter of their encampment.
keeping their eyes directed toward the space from which any danger might approach. They were seasoned veterans, and there was little they had not witnessed personally during their various tours of duty. All were wakeful and doing precisely what they had been taught to do, the ones in the forward line keeping a lookout for what might move in the dark in front of them, and the ones in the back keeping an eye on the ones just ahead of them. A good system, in most cases. But not this night. Not when these men needed to be looking behind them. The Scar Raiders, seven in all, including Arjun, swept in from the south, well behind the entire Federation encampment, cutting through a corridor that separated the watch on the western perimeter from the main body of the army. They had scouted the watch the night before to determine numbers and positions, so the Scar knew whom to look for and where. They were swift and sure. Seven lethal ghosts, invisible to those they passed, man and animal alike. They started with the back six guards, coming up on them without a sound, and silencing them with knives driven straight through the base of the skull, or across the throat, lowering each dead body silently to the earth before moving on. Not one sound was given to alert the front line of seven, and all seven went down in the same fashion as their brothers in arms. Their lives ended in seconds. The Scar assassins revealed themselves long enough to be sure that all their victims were dispatched, then converged on Arjun and Koldre. No words were spoken. None were necessary. The plan had been carefully detailed earlier, and all of them knew what to do. Retreating the way they had come, they melted into the darkness, disappearing as if they had never been there, making sure they were well away before allowing themselves to become visible again. They found their aircraft, boarded and flew westward, their return following the exact same path as their arrival, crossing the Myrmidon to the north bank when well upstream and winging their way back to the Scar encampment. "Now we will see," Koldre whispered in Arjun's ear as they drew near to their own fires. She nodded wordlessly. It was a big gamble, but a necessary one. She needed it to work in order to set in motion the events that would gain her the edge she needed over the Federation, and to manipulate things once her father arrived with the rest of the army and learned of her failure to prevent the loss of Paranor. Because she knew what would happen otherwise. He would strip her of her command and send her home in disgrace. It was what she would do, if she were him. 16. By the time he finally reached Embrun, Tavel Kanin had been on the road for 10 days. It would have taken longer, but in the end he had stolen a horse and ridden for the last 3 days of his journey. He was worn down both mentally and physically. He had killed 23 people. His parents and his uncle, Squit Malk, the men in the tavern, and the man on the road whom he had broken in order to find his sister. But it meant nothing to him. He no longer felt anything was wrong with killing, when he could justify it by pointing to the ways he had been mistreated. Flugan was quick to reassure him that he should not allow others to abuse or mislead him, and that anyone who did should expect to pay a price. If the cost of their transgressions was their lives, it was unfortunate for them, but no blame should attach to Tavo. That was Flugan's thinking, and now Tavo's as well. That was who he was. He was, in short, a creature he would not have recognized a few months earlier. His mind no longer worked as it once had. Yes, he still sought his sister, with the same relentless determination that had driven him from the beginning of his flight from Backing Fell, and nothing had changed to his way of thinking where Tasha was concerned. She had betrayed him. She had left him in his uncle's care, just as their parents had, and then abandoned him. Like everyone else, she deserved the retribution he planned to deliver. He entered Embrun, a ragged and soiled creature, his demons raging inside him and his desperate need to exact revenge on his sister beyond understanding, sitting astride the stolen horse he had ridden half to death. Flugan sat behind him, invisible to all who glanced his way, whispering steadily in his ear, urging him onward, prodding him relentlessly. Flugan was his friend, and he listened. But in truth, he felt the hold that Flugan once had on him beginning to weaken. He no longer needed Flugan as he had before. He better understood how powerful he was, how much in control of a magic that for so long had been in control of him. He understood that letting the magic guide him, that letting it think it was in control when actually it wasn't, allowed him to be its master. He saw no problem with this reasoning. He saw nothing wrong with his newfound conviction that he had mastered something so powerful simply by deciding to go along with its urges. It was early morning in the village, and there were few people about. Most who saw him turned their heads. Most sensed in him something they did not want to get close to. But these people did not matter. They were no different from trees or storefronts or animals. He would suffer them, but not allow them to deter him. Twice he stopped people to ask after Driska Ark, one a man, one a woman. Each time they were quick enough to respond, pointing him down the road and beyond the town. The woman gave more explicit guidance, however, telling him exactly where to go and what to look for. The druid had moved recently, she revealed. Someone had burned down his cottage. There was in her eagerness to reveal what she knew both fear and loathing. Which of these emotions was for Tavo, and which generated by mention of the man he asked after, it was difficult to say, but it didn't matter. A path to his destination had been provided, and Tasha would be waiting not too far ahead. He abandoned his horse just outside of town, climbing down gingerly and setting the animal loose to wander where it wanted. A man passing gave him a questioning look, but Tavo ignored him. The horse was a burden he no longer needed. The man hesitated, as if to reprimand him for his lack of care, then appeared to decide against it and passed on. Others he encountered gave him looks as well. He knew he was a sight, unwashed and blooded, his clothes ragged, his face drawn and scarred. He had eaten nothing in 3 days, save an apple and a half loaf of bread another traveller had offered him. He had found water, easily enough, but nothing else. Not that either food or water much mattered. He wasn't thinking of sustenance and didn't miss it. All of his attention was focused on reaching Tasha and putting an end to this part of his journey. Flukin walked beside him, jaunty and fresh-faced. He never seemed to change, not even in the smallest way. No dirt ever appeared on his face or hands or clothes. He never ate anything, at least not that Tavo saw, preferring to sit back and watch his friend eat. Perhaps it was his unselfish nature that caused him to forego food for the benefit of his companion. Perhaps he just didn't care all that much about food. It was hard to say. Everything about Flukin was confusing and vague, save his insistence on tracking down Tasha. They passed out of Embrun, leaving its shops and businesses behind, and moved into a residential district where stretches of forest separated the houses and outbuildings. A pair of children came running out of a patch of woods off to one side, caught sight of him and hesitated, then raced back into the trees. A dog barked at him from the end of a heavy chain. The dog was big and dangerous-looking, but Tavo just stared it down. In moments the dog had turned back, slinking away with a low growl. When he reached Driska Ark's cottage, he recognized it right away from the description the woman in the village had supplied. It was set well back from the road, a small building of white-painted boards and a brick chimney. A broad, covered porch ran the length of the front side, enclosed by an ornate metal railing and a broad wooden capstone. A pair of ancient, straight-backed chairs and 2 small tables occupied the available space and seemed entirely insufficient for the job. Tavo stood looking at the cottage for long minutes, trying to decide what to do. He needed to find his sister, but he didn't want her to see him and flee. He thought to call out, then stopped himself. Better just to walk up to the door and knock. He was on his way up the gravel pathway when the front door opened, and an old woman clothed in black appeared on the porch. She didn't see him at first. Her clear intent was to sit in one of the chairs. But even without looking at him, she seemed to sense him and turned, and the expression on her face stopped him in his tracks.
"Who are you?"
she demanded, in a tone of voice that suggested he ought to answer.
"I'm looking for my sister," he said. "Why look here? This is Driska Ark's home, isn't it? I was told she was coming here."
The old woman studied him a moment.
"What is your sister's name?"
Tavo was growing irritated. He didn't like being questioned, and it felt like this delay might be purposeful. What if Tasha was already slipping out the back?
"Tasha," he said.
The old woman shrugged. "She's not here. She was, but now she's gone." Suddenly Tava was infuriated. The old woman was lying. He could feel it. She was trying to help his sister.
"I know she's inside. You better tell her to get out here.
You better watch your tongue."
Tava smiled. "You don't know what will happen if you don't do what I say. You don't have any idea what I can do."
The old woman smiled back. She took a few steps along the porch and came down to the bottom of the steps.
"No, I don't. But I know what I can do, and it would be a whole lot worse than anything you could possibly imagine. I know about you. Your name is Tavo, isn't it? Are you like your sister, Tavo? Do you have magic, too?"
Tavo's face went dark with fear and anger. There was something about this old woman that made him pause. Even Fluken, standing off to one side, seemed hesitant. He did nothing to urge Tavo on, neither moving nor speaking, as he stood there, eyes on the old woman.
"Now do as I say," she said quietly, "and don't press your luck. I have magic too, Tavo, and I have spent many more years than you have discovering what it can do."
Then, abruptly, the door behind her opened, and Tasha stepped out onto the porch. Tasha was still bleary from her meeting with Driska, real or imagined, the night before, but she had heard the voices, and even in the warm, cocooning wrap of her slumber she recognized Tavo's. She had not believed it at first, but as she became more certain, she knew she had to go to him. She forced herself all the way awake, climbed from the covers, and walked through the cottage to the front door, still in her nightdress, listening as Clizia and Tavo conversed, and growing increasingly concerned over the tone of their voices. When she opened the door and stepped onto the porch, both stopped talking instantly. She gave Clizia a look.
"I want to talk to him," she said. "I have to."
The druid gave her a doubtful look, then stepped back to clear a path. Tasha came down the steps and walked past her.
"Hello, Tavo," she said when she was a dozen paces away.
She stopped, waiting on him. His face was hard to read. There was anger, but confusion as well, as if now that he had found her, he didn't know what to say, or didn't know if this meeting was even what he wanted. He stood there for long moments without speaking or moving, his eyes fixed on her.
"You laughed,"
he said finally. She nodded.
"To find help for you. To find the druid who lived here, so he could teach me how to help you with your magic."
He shook his head, an angry look in his dark eyes.
"No, you ran. You ran as fast and as far as you could to get away from me. You abandoned me to those creatures that called themselves my parents. And you left me to that monster that..."
She could see him spiraling out of control, and she held up her hands quickly to placate him.
"I know. I returned to Backingfell after you left, Tavo. I know what you did to them and why. I know you are hurting. You have to let me help you." "You don't want to help me," he screamed at her. "You wish I was dead. You hoped I was dead."
She shook her head.
"No, I don't wish that. I never wished that. I just didn't know what to do to help you. You told me to go away when I came to see you, even though I didn't want to. I knew you were in trouble, but Mama and Papa couldn't see it. But now I know better what the magic is and how it works. I know how to manage it, and how to help you manage it. Just let me..."
Tavo's fists were balled up at his sides, and his entire body was rigid.
"You filthy liar! Fluken knows! He knows you're lying! He can see you're trying to hide the truth, and he tells me!"
She looked to where he had glanced, but there was no one there. Who was Fluken? She tried again.
"What can it hurt to let me try to make things better, Tavo? What if I really can make the pain go away and the magic behave? What if I really can help you? Tavo, I love you. You're my brother. I would never leave you and not come back. Can't you see that?"
And for a moment, it seemed he could. The tenseness left his body and his face softened. He was back to being the boy he had been all those years ago when they were still close, before their parents had sent him to their uncle's farm to live. He blinked rapidly, tears welling in his eyes, and he shook his head as if waking from a dream.
"Tasha?"
he asked softly. She nodded, sensing she still had a chance.
"It's me, Tavo. I'm glad you found me. I will do everything I can to help you. I will try hard to make you feel better. We can work together."
He seemed to be listening, responding. Then suddenly he wasn't doing either. His expression became distracted and then turned vacant. With a swiftness that was terrifying, he transformed from the boy of 10 years ago to the enraged young man who had come to find her. All the softness disappeared, and the hard look that replaced it was so frightening it caused her to take a step back.
"Tavo," she whispered, but got no further.
"You witch!" he screamed at her. "You were going to trick me again, weren't you? Do you think I am so stupid I cannot see it?"
His fists opened and his fingers crooked like claws. His arms came up threateningly and thrust toward her.
"Tasha!"
Clizia Porce called in warning.
"Leave us!" Tasha shouted back. "Tavo and I must settle this ourselves."
She was conscious of Clizia's sharp hiss of disapproval. Then the other woman stepped away. Tavo was screaming something at her, sound and fury that defied any comprehension, and abruptly the madness that had recaptured him released in the howl of his wish song. His wild magic slammed into her with such force that she was thrown backward onto the gravel walkway. She did not lose consciousness, but she was dazed and weakened by the force of his attack, even so. Her own magic quickly sprang to her defense, a wall of sound that blocked Tavo's attack and shattered his efforts. Her brother staggered back but recovered quickly, staying upright as his eyes cleared, and he came at her again. His power was stronger than she remembered, more fully developed and less raw. It slammed her down once more, even before she could regain her footing, pinning her in place as he advanced. Wrapping herself in a new defense, she rolled away from his strike and managed to get to her knees before he changed tactics. But this time she was ready for him, and she lashed out in retaliation. Their magic collided in midair before bursting apart in an explosion of light and energy so powerful it shook Driska's cottage to its foundation and knocked Clizia backward out of view. Tasha rose once more, her body aching. Her brother glared at her, breathing hard, trying to recover himself.
"Tavo, stop this!" she cried to him. "We need to talk! There's no point in fighting!"
But her brother wasn't having any part of it. He attacked again, his magic coalescing into a barbed whirlwind that would have torn her apart had it been able to reach her. Yet it still came close enough to leave the exposed skin of her hands and face torn and blooded, and her body bruised. She broke his attack once more, but now she was nearly played out. She still hadn't recovered from her journey. She was still in need of rest. He was too strong for her. If the attack continued, he would destroy her. Which, she realized for the first time, was precisely what he wanted. He was far beyond reason. Like her parents and her uncle, she was going to die. So she had to find a way to bring him under control physically, to stop the attacks and make him listen to her. Looking into his eyes as he prepared to come at her one more time, she found no hint of the brother she had known as a child, no indication of affection or trust. He was a soulless monster, consumed by rage and hate and driven by a mindless need for revenge. She felt herself lose hope. Pavel's voice rose to a crescendo and hammered into her. It struck her with such force that it effortlessly broke apart her defenses, throwing her 12 feet into the air, holding her in place 3 feet off the ground and then slamming her down. The air went out of her. Her vision wavered in a wash of pain and sadness, and everything went black. From where she crouched at the corner of the porch, Clizia Porce watched Tavo Kanin walk forward to stare down at his fallen sister. She was probably already dead, and if she weren't, she soon would be. Tavo wasn't looking at his sister with anything that even approached compassion. He was clearly trying to determine whether she really was dead, or if more was needed to make her so. So Clizia acted, knowing that if she let him end Tasha's life, it would ruin everything she needed to accomplish with Driska Ark, and she wasn't about to let that happen just to satisfy some half-mad sibling's insane compulsion. At the same time, she was wondering if perhaps there might be a use for him. After all, he did possess the most powerful magic she had seen in many a moon. If it wasn't the wish song itself, it was a close approximation. And if it was the wish song, That meant both brother and sister were descendants of the Ungsford bloodline, perhaps the only ones left in all the four lands. Which would explain Driska Ark's decision to accept Tasha as his student. But whatever she was going to do about Tavo Kanan, she had to do it fast and she had to handle it in the right way. No ordinary approach would work with someone this irrational. She rose, watching for any threatening movements from him, but he just stood staring down at his sister, seemingly oblivious.
"Tavo," she called.
"Go away!
Step away from Tasha. Let your sister be."
"I let her be when she's dead. And she's not quite dead yet,"
Clesia exhaled. Good news, if so.
"Why don't you hear me out first? I have a use for Tasha, an important use which might be good for you as well. So perhaps you would consider waiting a bit longer to kill her? I know she deserves to die, but why not let her live a while in expectation of what might happen? If you kill her while she is unconscious, it will mean nothing. She won't have a chance to regret the way she hurt you. Tavo, look at me!"
Tavo looked, his gaze blank, his face expressionless once more. The anger was gone, and he no longer seemed to be interested in talking to whatever ghosts accompanied him. Whoever Fluken was, he seemed to have faded from his consciousness for the moment.
"You and I are not so different," she spoke quietly, her voice modulated to be persuasive and calming.
She knew how to do this, and during the long years of her life it had served her well.
"We have both suffered grave hurt at the hands of others, our lives tortured and twisted by those who wanted us gone. We have both endured injustice and misunderstanding through no fault of our own. You have great magic. So do I. You have suffered because of how you have struggled with it. So have I. We are so much more alike than we are different. Give me a chance to tell you more."
She was pleading with him as an equal, a fellow sufferer at the hands of an amorphous, faceless array of enemies, ingratiating herself by identifying with him and letting him identify with her. Tavo stared at her a minute and then nodded.
"Your sister said she would try to help you master your magic, to find a way to bring it under control. I will do much more than that. I will teach you how to use it, so that it will serve your purposes. I will give you a way to vent your hatred and gain revenge over those who would make your life miserable. I will give you access to a power you have not even begun to dream of. You have power in your voice, granted, but you don't yet understand all the ways that power can be used. Even more to the point, you don't have all the tools you need to accomplish the great things you were born to do."
His brow knit and his face darkened.
"Why would you do this?"
"Why not? If you can help me in return? If it allows us to help each other? Do we not need to band together, we who are the victims of uncaring parents and neighbors and friends? We do not deserve to be victims. We should be victors."
He was nodding with her now, agreeing with her assessment, even though she was doubtful he really understood what she was saying. She resisted the urge to step closer to him, standing hunched over in her dark robes to make herself appear less threatening, more innocuous.
"Here is what I promise you," she continued, now that she had his undivided attention. "Stand with me, Tavo, and I will give you power that will allow you to punish all those who might hurt you. I will give you a chance to discover how you might change the very world you live in. No one will ever lock you away again. No one will ever threaten you again. Others will stand back from you in awe, and they will fear you. They will treat you with respect. This is what I will give you if you will let me make use of your sister for a short time."
She had no intention of doing any of this, but her plans were not fully formed as yet. So mostly she was buying time for herself and Tasha. This brother of hers was clearly insane and incredibly dangerous. That she could bend him to her will, persuade him to her cause, was a risk she must take for now. She must lead him to believe she would do all the things she had promised. But in the end he was expendable, and must be eliminated, if for no other reason than to assure her personal safety.
"You could be lying,"
he said, as if reading her mind.
"There would be no point in lying."
She came forward a few steps now, hands held out as if in